Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello and welcome to The Great Indoors,
the podcast which reveals everything you ever need to know about interiors and explains how to make it all really work for you in your home.
I'm Kate Watson-Smythe.
And I'm Sophie Robinson.
And thank you to our brand new sponsor, Geberit. I always say the bathroom is the first room you should do up when renovating, so you've got somewhere clean to cry when the dust and building works all get a bit too much.
Yes, and we all dream of that perfect bathroom sanctuary. But the most important factor has to be, how is this bathroom going to make my life easier and more efficient in the morning?
Exactly. For me, how can I get two teenagers and a mad husband in and out without a row and everybody on time? It's about looking carefully at the choices we make in relation to the people who are using the room.
And Geberit have lots of really innovative products that can really help with this. So do check out their website for energy efficient and new and innovative ideas. Now, coming up today, we are tackling everything home happiness. First up, we're going to talk about applied colour psychology. Then we've got a brilliant interview with the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute, Mike Viking. And finally, we've rounded up some of the latest books which are tackling this very subject. And also, welcome to our new segment at the end of the show, our very own style surgery, where we get to answer our listeners' questions.
So, first up, you might remember that last episode we heard from Sarah Aubrey in Australia, who was trying to choose a colour to replace the grey walls in her study. We advised her to start by identifying the feeling she needed to create in that room, and then to work out which colour would help encourage that feeling. But we do know that's not necessarily an easy task, so we thought we'd try and break it down for you. And Sophie, of course, is queen of colour psychology, so over to you, Sophie, in the duvet den.
Well, I literally have this month just launched my next online course, Colour Psychology and How to Create a Harmonious Home. To share this incredible technology as a way of unlocking exactly that. What colour should you use in your home, and where should you use it, and what kind of emotional effect that's going to have on your happiness and your well-being. Essential stuff, I think, when we're designing interior spaces, that we really understand how the choices we make make us feel, and make us feel our best, essentially.
So you're saying we don't just rush into a room and going, oh my God, I really want to paint this room pink. You have to think about how to find the right shade of pink that is going to make you feel the right way for the room you're in.
Yeah, exactly. Because we all have really personal reactions to colour. So for example, Kate, let's talk about yellow, shall we?
Do we have to?
See, already. Yeah, exactly, already. So I can see you're completely toes curling. Whereas yellow is a colour that I really love to use on my home. I couldn't have it on the walls. It would be too much for me on as a wall colour. But I love it in the artwork that I choose, in accessories, a pop of cushions. There's nothing better than a sunny bowl of tulips or daffodils on my kitchen table.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yes, because I just think those tulips and those daffodils need to stay right out there in the garden. I do not want them in my house.
But then if I was to say to you, you know, like a turmeric or a saffron yellow, I could probably get you on board with that.
You probably could. That sort of old gold, bit more faded, bit more, let's be honest, greyed out. That's going to work better for me. That's really interesting. So it's about, and I think it's quite visceral, isn't it? My reaction to yellow, you know, it does kind of hit me in the stomach. I don't like it when it's the wrong shade of yellow for me. So the point, I suppose, what I would say is there's no such thing as the wrong colour. It's just the wrong shade, or you've got to find the right shade for you.
Now, this is all stuff that psychologist Angela Wright was absolutely fascinated with. She started working in the 70s, wrote a brilliant book called Colour Psychology for Beginners in the 90s. And I first met Angela in the early noughties when I was working on a magazine, and we did a whole feature on this. And she, as a psychologist, was just so interested on how different people have different reactions to the same colour. And she was also really interested, just going back to our tulips and daffodils, how nature changes its colour palettes throughout the season. So there's two things to this framework. There's one, which is our individual relationship with colour and how we react to it emotionally. And the other thing is what she calls colour harmony. So how groups of colours sit together and create a feeling of well-being. So this is why she came up with these four seasonal personalities that I talk about, both in my blog and it's the core content of this online course, is so essential to work out which palette of colour. It's an energy as well. It's not just about colour. It's about a whole kind of mood and feeling and energy. So, for example, let's talk about the spring yellows, the spring flowers. That is an energy of uplift, of newness, of optimism. It's youthful. There's loads of lovely, warm, gentle sunlight at this time of year. It's quite a busy time of year as well for getting in the garden. So the palette of colours that go with this sort of energetic personality type are colours that are light and buoyant. They have a lot of clarity. They have a lot of uplift. And they're quite optimistic and youthful colours. Moving into summer, forget your Bermuda shorts and your blow-up pink flamingo poolside accoutrements. It's not that. You think of summer more of a kind of a soft and gentle time of year. It's a time for taking holidays, relaxing, it's sun bleach. So the colours are fading now. We don't have those bright, perky crocus and tulip colours. We're more into sort of the hydrangeas, wisteria, roses, a lot more of a blousy, sort of elegant, graceful vibe going on in summer. If you think of cool summer evenings, glass of wine, that sort of thing. So the mood has shifted from one of uplift and energy into something that feels a lot more calmer and still and relaxed. So the palette of colours that go with this mood of the summer palette are all those colours that are quite mid-tone, which means that they're not very taxing on the eye. They're quite easy to look at. There's no high contrast, there's no high energy, and they have a sort of underlying greyness to them. Think of those Farrow and Ball kind of grey colours. That's a very, very summer colour palette.
So we need to work out, essentially what you're saying is we need to work out what season we are. And I should just put a bracket in here. This is not that 1980s dressing like the seasons thing, is it? I mean, that was a disaster. My mother had her colours done. Yes, she only wore magenta and navy blue for about 10 years. And she had a whole wardrobe had to be replaced. It was a disaster. But it's not that then. So these are not those colours. You've got to put aside all your prejudice of that colour me beautiful. This is a completely different thing.
And again, this is heavily scientifically researched. And the reason why I've picked it up as an interior designer is because it does really work. When you sort of understand the seasonal personalities, you can understand that different people do resonate with different palettes of colour. So for example, Kate, coming onto the next season, autumn, I'd say that's you. Colours become a lot richer, a lot more grounded. There's a little bit of black added to those colours, so they're a bit heavier, richer, more robust. So all your lovely chocolates, and even though you have pink in your house, it's not a pretty, uplifting pink. It's quite a blushy, earthy, plastery pink. Well, there you go. That's the important thing, isn't it? And also your love of vintage and books and your sort of library and all your lovely artisan rugs. This is all very much that lovely, cosy, grounded autumn palette that you really react to. And then finally, the last palette is winter. If we think of winter as a season of extremes, you think of that piercing winter sunlight and just the fact that there are no leaves on the trees. Everything's very architectural, very striking on the landscape. And the colours are cold. We're looking at cold black, white, silver, chrome.
But there can't be very many winter people then. I mean, who's, you know, black and white and silver? That can't... think of many people who would want their houses.
Well, you think of the whole 80s trend. You remember all that black leather and chrome furniture? 80s was a very winter.
Oh, decade.
And yeah. The people were making a lot of money. You know, a lot of winter people tend to be very successful. They like to show off their wealth. So you'll find a lot of kind of like penthouse apartments in Canary Wharf with big glassy kind of, you know, floor to ceiling skylines, or Manhattan apartments with that Mies van der Rohe black leather chaise. Quite minimal. That would be quite a winter interior.
So I've got a question for you then. If you then worked in finance, for example, and moved into a penthouse in Canary Wharf, if that didn't feel necessarily like your style of decor, but if you surrounded yourself by that, could you make yourself into that successful person, or would it not work?
No, it would strain you.
Right.
So this is what happens is if you get it wrong,
it's a disaster.
I think a lot of people are projecting what they think they want to be or who they think they are. And the effect of that is you won't feel happy and you'll feel drained and it will be a strain. There's a lovely bit in Angela's book that she wrote about a young girl in the office who was working with her. And she was clearly, she said, a spring person, very sprightly. She had very pale blonde hair, twinkly blue eyes, high energy. But she used to wear a lot of black because she wanted people to take her seriously. And she thought if she wore black, then, you know, she'd come across as a lot more authoritative. And then one day she just came into work in quite a light coral dress, and everyone complimented on how amazing she looked. And her whole energy was completely transformed, not just in the way she looked, but in the way she behaved and the way she felt. And Angela, knowing her work in colour psychology, talked to her about it. And she said, yeah, I did. Every day I usually get home from work and I feel absolutely knackered. I'm completely drained. But when I started wearing colours that are more uplifting and bright, more suited to her personality, it gave her energy. So I think it's a really interesting thing to look at. I had an amazing girl on one of my workshops. She's really cool. She dressed really snazzy. And she came to me, sort of, we did all the work on colour psychology in the morning. I got them all mood boarding. And she came to me and she went, oh my God, I've just realised that I'm a summer personality. So summer is soft, elegant, understated, very washed out, cool colours. And she said, my whole house is black and brass and edgy and techie and crittle windows and black and white patterned flooring. Very cool, very edgy. I think probably what she thought she wanted to be. But actually, she found that she was the complete antithesis of that. Summer is all about understatement and subtlety and being quite classic. So honestly, sometimes when people come home from workshops, their world is completely rocked and it can be quite emotional.
Quite expensive as well, by the sounds of things.
Yeah. Or it can be very life-affirming. And people really realise that we do know what we loved and drawn to. And I think this is the big take home for people listening. You do have this. You do know. Yes, you can listen to trend forecasters and experts like ourselves. But essentially, start looking around your home at the colours you surround yourself, even the colours you choose to wear, those colours that make you feel good, not the colours you think you should be wearing. And generally get in touch with that gut feeling of what gives me that uplift, what gives me that feeling of joy. Because colour, literally, it's such a powerful tool. It is emotion. Literally, light is an energy wave. It hits our retina. It gets pinged off to the same part of our brain as where we process our emotions. So it is that critical that we have this relationship with colour. So know that colour is very personal. Don't listen to your mother-in-law. Don't listen to your best friend. Certainly don't listen to us on what colours you should have in your home. This is purely personal. And then really get in touch with how those colours make you feel. I'd argue that you probably want to have a different feeling in your bedroom than you do in your kitchen, for example.
Fascinating stuff. So do let us know if you have a go at this exercise, making a list of words or emotions that you want to feel in a room and the colours you then discover that help you feel those emotions. We'd love to know either anything new you discover or even perhaps where, like the crittle window lady, you've gone wrong. Do share it with us on our Facebook page, which is The Great Indoors Podcast. And for more details of Sophie's colour psychology course, you can find on her website at sophierobinson.co.uk, and she'll put a link to it there.
So coming up, a new crop of luscious design books to sink our teeth in. But first, just before we started recording today, I had a chat to someone whose insight and expertise is incredibly relevant to our current situation. He was someone I was lucky enough to meet last year as he just launched some fresh new scientific research on home happiness. So as soon as we went into lockdown, I was super keen to hear his take. He is Mike Viking, a New York Times bestseller. Over a million copies of his book, The Little Book of Hygge, have already sold. And he is the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute, based in Copenhagen. And thanks for bearing with us on this less than perfect audio quality. The Sussex countryside to Denmark was quite a test of my Wi-Fi.
I know the Happiness Research Institute sounds like a magical place, and people imagine that all we do is eat ice cream and you know, play with puppies. But unfortunately, that's not the case. So we try to look at happiness, well-being, and quality of life from a scientific perspective. So we use a lot of data, we use studies, we use evidence to try and understand how we can measure happiness. Secondly, why are some people happier than others? And thirdly, how can we improve quality of life? So when we know what we know, how should we design our policies differently, our cities differently, but basically also our homes and our lives differently? So that's what we try to do.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, absolutely astonished me, even though, you know, I've been working in the realm of interior design and home improvement for 25 years, and I absolutely love my subject. But one thing that I was quite astonished about this research is home happiness came out as number two overall in the sort of key elements that make our happiness. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and I think it's been an overlooked area when we look at which factors impact how we feel. And I think, you know, the reason why homes have a big impact is we spend a lot of time in our homes. You know, it's where we spend the most time, most of us. And I think we can also see we change behavior, we change mood depending on where we are. I experienced this firsthand a lot because I usually travel a lot, and now these are Corona times, so all travel are stalled. But usually I spend about 80 or 100 days per year outside Copenhagen. And I can see my behavior changes depending on the city I'm in and also depending on sort of the hotel room I'm in. You know, some hotel rooms you are more likely to get out of as quickly as possible. And some hotel rooms, you just want to spend as much time in there as possible.
So that's some of the design elements then coming into play, is it?
Exactly. And I think, I mean, I think it was Churchill that said, you know, we shape our cities and then they shape us. But I think that's also true for the home. You know, we shape our homes, but they also impact how we feel and how we act. And I think that's been overlooked for a long time.
What were the key things that came out in terms of what does it take to feel happy in your home?
Well, we looked at different factors. We looked at comfort, we looked at safety, we looked at access to green areas, and we did a huge study around what drives happiness and well-being throughout Europe. So not just the UK, but 10 different countries in Europe.
And did you find more in common or more differences with our European friends?
I would say more in common than differences. And I think one of the interesting findings was that it's not necessarily about the amount of square meters or square footage in your apartment. That didn't explain differences in satisfaction with homes. But what did explain differences in satisfaction with homes was the sense of space.
Ah, that's quite a big thing, because I know here in the UK, especially, I'm married to a builder. He does a lot of side return extensions, loft conversions, you know, putting extra space on the back of people's houses. You know, there is a big trend for people wanting to add more space to their homes. But what you're saying is your research found that that isn't necessarily the key to having a better sense of happiness in your home. It's more of a sense of space.
Right. And I think that that's a positive finding, actually, because it means, I'm not trying to put your husband out of business, but it means that we don't have to necessarily we don't necessarily have to add extensions to our house. Maybe we can just, this is your expertise, redesign how we live. Another, I think, interesting finding was that a lot of people dream of owning their own place. And we could see in some countries that did explain some of the differences in satisfaction with our homes. But what we found, for instance, in Germany was that was not the case. And the interesting thing about Germany is that there is a lot of people who rent. So that is more the norm than it is in Denmark and the UK. So what we probably see there is what we often find in happiness research is that we are social beings. We compare ourselves with other people. So if a lot of our friends and colleagues and so on, if they own their own homes, we are more likely to feel that we also need to own our own home. So that's why we see in, for example, in Germany, that wasn't the case. That didn't explain happiness or satisfaction with our homes.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I know from an interior design point of view, a lot of the frustration people have with rented property is not being able to put your own stamp on it, your own sense of style. And some people feel that they have to compromise how they want their home to look because landlords aren't allowing them to, say, paint or put fixtures to the walls, or they might have to put up with a kitchen that isn't really designed how they'd like it to work.
Exactly. And I think another factor we saw was sort of the sense of control you feel mm-hmm. you have over your home. And exactly as you describe, if you are renting a place, then you don't have the same level of control over how the paint, you maybe you want to, you know, tear down a wall and so on. And you don't have that same ability when you're renting compared to owning. I'm currently right now in my home office. I'm, as you, surrounded by books. I'm surrounded by, you know, a painting of the farm my grandfather grew up on. I'm surrounded by a painting that was given to me by my editor after I published my last book. And we think of something, we remember something when we see something that triggers the memory of that. So our mind, our memory works through association. So if we gather stuff that remind us of happy times, we are more likely to think of those happy times in the future. So I think especially these days when a lot of us are forced indoors because of the coronavirus, this is even more important that we surround ourselves with the memories of happy times we've had. And also we spend a lot of time indoors, so we have to sort of make the best circumstances for that. So again, I'm in my home office. I'm sitting by what I think is a beautiful desk. And I want to sit down and write. And I want to sit down and research. Whereas if you decorate a room where you make the television the centerpiece, then your behavior will probably change to let's go on the couch and watch some telly. And I think we can nudge ourselves through interior design to become the version of ourselves that we would actually like to become.
Okay, so are you saying that when we're looking at designing our room and making choices about the colours and the things we have around us, it's really important to start with what you want to do and achieve in that room?
So a couple of years ago, I was in Provence in southern France, and we visited the studio of a painter. It was a beautiful, beautiful painting studio, and there was a huge window facing the north. There was, of course, canvases. There was different fruit that he used to paint still life. And next to the huge window to the north, there was a giant sort of, almost looked like a letterbox in the wall. That was used to get the big canvases he was using in and out of the room. So this entire room was designed for painting. Now, I've never painted in my life. I'm horrible at sketching and drawing and basically everything involves drawing anything. But in that room, for the first time in my life, I actually wanted to paint.
Wow, how extraordinary.
That's the power of what a room can do in terms of your motivation, in terms of your mood, in terms of your behavior. So I think we need to explore that further. And Sophie, can I turn this around for a second?
Yeah.
Because I also have a couple of questions, because my main focus is happiness. Your main focus is design and interior design. How do you see that connection between sort of your world and my world?
Oh, I'm all over it. I mean, I think I kind of felt like I always kind of knew it. Even childhood memories, my parents were real fixer-uppers. But just seeing that transformation of a house from something that was damp and depressing or magnolia into this beautiful light-filled home, I was like, wow, you can create such an incredible transformation. And I think it made such an impact on me. And then when you know, I found all this scientific research. I thought, no, it isn't just plumping cushions and flicking through paint charts. You know, it is when you bring in how you use the space, what you're doing in there, who are you with, what are your experiences you're building in that home. All of that comes in with the design.
And I think it's also interesting that you had that awareness of your ability to change something, growing up, seeing your parents do what they did, I think is really, really empowering. And I think that gives us a sense of control. And I think that comes back to sort of my field in terms of satisfaction with life or happiness. You know, when we feel we have control, when we feel we can influence and impact things we are, you know, dissatisfied with, that's a great sense of empowerment and self-esteem that I think spills over in terms of happiness and quality of life.
So do you do a lot of home improvement yourself? Do you tackle any DIY?
Very little. Very little. My girlfriend is much better at it than I am.
Oh, brilliant.
So I always call in either her for reinforcements or my dad, who's really good at it. I think we both have really strong opinions about design. So we have fierce debates over design.
So Mike, as we're all shut down indoors at the moment, self-isolating, have you got any tips? And I know it's an incredibly challenging time for absolutely everybody and keeping our positivity up. Have you got any happiness hacks of how we can feel upbeat at this troubling time?
These are indeed difficult times. We try to make the best of it. I spend more time in the kitchen these days, so we spend a lot of time cooking. I mean, bringing good food on the table is always something that sort of can boost your mood. I also spend a lot of time with books these days, more than I used to, because books have this tremendous ability to allow us to travel, not just in time, but also in space. So since we can't travel anywhere these days, it's a way to explore the world from the comfort of our homes. And then I connect with people. You know, we have technology that allows us to connect, even though we are in separate places. So go for a hike if you need a daily adventure. Stay away from people. But access to green areas is always good. And spend more time with books and food.
Brilliant. I sign up to all of those. Thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Sophie. Thanks.
And I wish you all the happiness.
Likewise.
Thanks so much to Mike. And do look out for his books, The Little Book of Hygge and The Little Book of Lucca. And when you're next in Copenhagen, pop along to his Happiness Museum. I know I'll definitely be making that a destination on my trip list as soon as I'm allowed out the house.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Right, Sophie, you've got rid of the dog. I've shut the cat out. Let's talk about books, baby. Now, some of us have got more time to read right now, I appreciate, which is great. On the other hand, some of us are busier than we ever have been, juggling kids and work and endless virtual meetings, building duvet dens, battling with the tech. It's never ending. But we have got a couple of books for you which offer some really fabulous escapism and inspiration.
So the two books that we have got to review for you are hot off the press. First book is called Making Living Lovely by 2LG Studio, which is literally out today, 16th of April. So it doesn't get hotter off the press than that. And the other book by Michelle Ogundahin, Happy Inside, is even hotter off the press because it's not even actually off the press yet until the 30th of April. So we're giving you a little bit of a sneak preview on that. But both books deal with well-being and happiness at home. So we felt that they were really important that we got them into this episode as we are talking about all things happy. So which one do you want to talk about first, Kate?
Oh, I don't know. What do you think? Let's go in with Russell and Jordan's book, Making Living Lovely, which I loved. I mean, I have to say, first of all, it is a very good looking book.
It's this lovely cobalt blue cover with a kind of like rose gold metallic. So we're all about the design before we've even gone into the content, aren't we? Rose gold design kind of typography. Really, really sexy looking.
The premise of their book is sort of free your home with creative design. So you want to create a home that facilitates your life and lifts your spirits. It's inspired by you and it also inspires you. And I think, you know, that's a really good starting point. That's what we all want to do, isn't it? Design is a luxury, not a lifestyle, they say. I like that.
We know the boys, Russell and Jordan, who wrote this book and who make up 2LG Studio very well. They're big on Instagram. They're in the UK media a lot and they've got their own design studio based in London. And their real moniker is very bright and uplifting interiors, isn't it? They're not afraid of colour. They're very pioneering in a lot of their design ideas, I think. So it was very interesting, really, considering that they are a London design studio, that they've got actually quite a humble approach to design. I found that was quite a pleasing surprise. Taking the word lovely, I thought that was really interesting. Making living lovely. Lovely is not a word that gets used by professional interior designers very often. It's too soft, isn't it? But they were really adamant that they feel this word lovely is what it's all about. It's a much softer approach to decorating.
I thought there was a really interesting bit at the beginning where they talk about freeing yourself from interiors FOMO, obviously fear of missing out. And they say, you know, oh, I'm that person. I want to create the perfect interior for the perfect Instagram shot. Oh, I want all of that. Oh, and I want that as well. And oh, I don't need it, but I want it. They address all those things, which I think is really common at the moment, not least because we have so much inspiration from Instagram and Pinterest. And sometimes we just are swayed by beautiful pictures rather than thinking about, you know, what we want and like. So I thought that was really a really good marker right at the beginning, that this is about finding what you like and what's right for you and not worrying about your neighbours.
What's really interesting is they are professional interior designers. They are doing up clients' homes. And I was just sort of reading that thinking, gosh, this must be all the kind of stuff that comes out in their original briefings. People's anxiety about it looking good, people's anxiety about what other people are going to judge them for the way their home looks. And part of their job as an interior designer is to help people get beyond that.
There is that really good example, I think, which they say is a true story about how they went to meet a potential client and discovered through the course of talking to her that she absolutely hated every single thing in her house because she wanted to live in a submarine.
Right, and what that's they say quite is, niche.
That's quite niche. Not actually a submarine, but she had decorated as her friends, her family, her neighbours had sort of thought she ought to. And what she really wanted was the complete sort of pared back, minimal, everything in its place, everything tidy look, which, you know, she sort of likened to a submarine where, you know, you've got a small amount of space. And I thought that was a really interesting point they make, that, you know, you have to do it for you. So they break it down into sort of a roadmap, which I really like, where you pick three colours, three materials, three feelings and three functions, and then maybe give it a title, which can be a song or a book or a film or even just, you know, a mood that you want in your house. And then you've got a list of things to kind of bring that together. So it is quite a clear roadmap, as they say, as to how to go about creating a design room.
And I think it's also interesting to highlight that neither Russell or Jordan are classically trained interior designers. They started off as actors and surrounded themselves in the theatre, then became a finalist on a very famous interior design TV show that you may or may not have heard of.
Oh, which one was that? I can't think.
I was going to call it The Great Indoors then.
What?
The Great Interior Design Challenge. They're finalists on that. So they've come at it through a different road. And I think that somehow that can be really freeing for a designer when you haven't been classically trained in something. They've really just tapped into their own love of design. And the book is them very generously sharing what that is.
And they've got a couple of great cheat sheets, which I loved, you know, sort of different architectural styles explained. So this is Brutalist, this is Country Cottage. And then they've also got another one on different styles. This is Memphis, this is Scandi. So that gives you some reference points as well to work out what you like and where you might sit in the spectrum of interior design. But they've got lots of other sort of interesting style tips as well. So they give you suggestions for combinations of textures and patterns, or there's a lot of stuff on vegan design. I think both boys are vegan, and sustainability and how you can use, you know, waste materials which have been repurposed into, you know, coasters and leftover plastic and things. So there's a lot in this book, which I really like.
I mean, on the subject of them helping you find your style, I would just say they have a style. This isn't a catch-all in terms of styling. The 2LG Studio is a really modern look. It's erring on minimal.
Well, I think they call it joyful minimalism. So it is quite minimal, but it's a bit more colourful than your classic minimalism.
Well, going back to my colour psychology at the top of the show, I'd say they were a spring-winter personality.
There you go.
So they're using all those buoyant, clear, uplifting, positive, youthful colours of spring, but making it feel edgy and designery and dramatic with that kind of like winter season coming in. So that's definitely their look. And if you're drawn to those sort of pastel brights and clean pioneering design, then you'll find lots and lots of interest. If you're doing up a chintzy country cottage, not so much.
So all in all, I think it's a good book. Before we move on to Michelle's book, I must apologise if you can hear some noise in the background. My next door neighbour, two houses away, likes to practice his drums at this time of day. And as there's no traffic or any other noise, you may hear a little bit in the background, or you may not. It will be interspersed with yowls from the cat who is trying to open the door and come back into my professional recording studio. Now, Michelle's book, my word.
This is a tome.
This is a big un. It's called Happy Inside, and it's due out on the 30th of April. I will tell you this, that in the first 31 pages, she's quoted Warren Buffett, Winnie the Pooh, Fight Club, and Socrates with a bit of Buddhism thrown in. So, you know, it's definitely a reader, not a flicker. Sophie, how did you get on?
Well, you want to know, don't you? Because I've already made it very clear on this podcast that I'm a flicker, not a reader. I mean, the Making Living Lovely was very flickable for me. Lots of lovely pictures in there. Thank you very much, boys. Michelle, not so much with the flicking. But I'm going to surprise you, Kay. I absolutely loved this book.
Did you?
And I surprised myself. It is a reader for sure. Let's just remind everybody who Michelle is. So Michelle Agunton trained as an architect, 13 years at the helm of Elle Decoration UK magazine, and now latterly the head judge on BBC2's Interior Design Masters. I mean, this woman knows her interior design onions like no other. And she's so bossy with it. I just think it's brilliant. And I'm just kind of like, I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years, but I sit and read her book and I went, oh, right, Michelle. Yes, Michelle. Anything you say, Michelle. I mean, she's just so like telling you how it's got to be. And I'm just adoring it because it's not my natural instinct, I have to say.
I think she takes a very holistic approach. So, you know, there are 9 chapters in this book and there are chapters on, yes, decorating your bedroom, but all about also how to sleep well and the rules of good sleep. She talks about how to decorate your bathroom and talks about, you know, toxins in cleaners and all that kind of thing. So it's a full-on approach. And I actually didn't read it from cover to cover in one sitting because I felt there was so much information in there that I read it over a period of time because I needed to kind of stop and absorb what I'd read. And, you know, it's quite scary. I mean, she tells you, and, you know, anyone who's thinking that they may have a bit of time at the moment, your first task is to make an inventory of everything you own. This will be about 300,000 items. And she freely says you might lose the will to live while you're doing it, but you've got to do it because then you work out what you've got and what you don't need and what you can get rid of.
Well, she says you probably only use 100,000 of those 300,000.
Yes, exactly.
the problem is I've probably got more like 600,000 things.
Yes, well, you know, that might take you a bit more time. But she talks in terms of decluttering, but not in the Marie Kondo sense. She makes a very clear distinction between stuff and things. And I really like that, you know, things that tell your story, that have memories, that, you know, remind you of places you've been and people you've met, as opposed to stuff, which we've all got too much of. And, you know, by making this inventory of things, she says, you might discover that you've got four sets of salad servers. You don't need that. So get rid of three of them. So it's about a massive sort of declutter and letting go of stuff so that you can create a home that is full of things, which is much better for you.
Are you taking this on board because you've always resisted the Marie Kondo? Is she chipping away at you? Are you feeling inspired to go and do your 300,000 inventory?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm quite ready for that yet, but I'm very on board with this idea of the difference between stuff and things. Before you even get as far as the design, you have to have this clear out and paring down, and only then can you work out how you need to do your home and what you need to do.
She even goes as far as saying, banish clutter, it's the arch enemy of a restful home. That made me sit up and take notice. And she says, and not only should you banish clutter, but you should commit to buying less as a result. So there's a lot to do with, you know, this is all about well-being and happiness. And this is all to do with the fact that, and it's a very Buddhist thing as well, as you have less, it creates less anxiety. And also connecting back to what Mike Viking was saying in his research of home happiness, Michelle says, you don't need more space. You just need less stuff. And she's almost stripping back on all that consumerism, not just because we don't need it, more to do with the fact that we won't find happiness in all these things. And actually, it could be doing the opposite and making us feel quite anxious.
And she then goes into, once you've sort of worked your way through that, you know, how you would design a room. And there are sort of numbers. I mean, there are 28 notes per room, which is very specific. 6 core colours, 2 accent colours, 2 metallics, 2 woods and so on. There are 4 home zones. So there's the hall, the entranceway. Then there's the kind of kitchen, dining, reception. There's the kitchen, study and home office, which are where you might do the creating of food, but also of your work. And then the bed and the bathroom. And then there are the 7 principles. You know, there is a lot to take on board. It is completely rewarding if you dive into it, but you need to dive in.
I think she's very methodical. She's really thought this through. She's really broken it down. What I would say is that on one hand, I question whether this is an intro level book. Like if you were stuck going, what goes under my red sofa? Is this book going to help you? Maybe it will, but I think it's a lot to get your head around. But for me, as someone who has surrounded myself in interior design all my life, I feel like there's so much to learn here. So that's what I'm finding so exciting about this book is, yes, a lot of what she's saying, I kind of have heard already, but the way she packages it and makes it a very methodical process to follow is really quite refreshing, isn't it?
There are a couple of things to sort of take out so that people aren't feeling overwhelmed with information. One of which is she talks about your sitting room, and that can be quite an aimless room in that we know the bedroom is for sleeping, we know the bathroom is for washing, we know the kitchen is for cooking, but the sitting room can have many purposes and can end up sort of fulfilling nothing of them. So she would say, you know, if your sitting room is for relaxing, then make sure it does that. So she talks about buying the biggest sofa you can fit in the space. That sofa should hug you. And I thought that was, you know, really interesting, is defining again that purpose for that room so that it makes you happy to be in it. And another little takeout I got from there was where she goes into the kitchen and says, you know, we all have perhaps parents or relatives who've not used stuff because they're saving it for best. And she says, you know, nothing should be saved for best, because what are you saying for your self-esteem if you're saving it for best? Are you saying that you're not good enough to use that stuff every day? And I thought that was a really interesting point. And that kind of goes throughout the whole book. So you learn so much from reading this book that isn't just about interior design, but is about sort of the whole, as I say, holistic approach to creating a home. And we will have more details on both those books on our blogs. She's sophierobinson.co.uk and I'm madaboutthehouse.com. So we'll have some pictures and some more explanation of the books on there.
We We enjoyed all your questions so much in our Staying In special episode, so we've decided to make our style surgery a little bit of a regular thing. So for this episode, let's hear today's listener query.
This is Catherine from Leon C, and my question is, we're just about to move into a new house and we want to paint the house from top to bottom, and we would be interested to know, is it more important to buy a good quality paint or a good quality brush, or equally important to buy both? And what type of paint or what paint manufacturer would you recommend?
So, Catherine, brilliant question. To start off with the quality paint brush element of that question, I'd say yes. From experience, it is worth spending out on quality paintbrushes. Whenever you buy cheap ones, they always start shedding at some point. So I think it's worth investing in good brushes and looking after them. Obviously, if you're doing brushwork, it's usually on woodwork, doors and architraves or kitchen cupboards or things like that. So you do want something as well that just gives you a lovely flat finish as you're stroking the paint onto the surface. And again, the better quality brushes will do that. But actually, you know, when you're in your decorator's centre, ask for their advice. They usually have brilliant advice because there's different brushes for water-based, different brushes for oil-based, different brushes for windows. It's a whole thing.
You can get those great angled brushes, can't you, for corners?
Or for the sash windows as well. Oh, yeah, sash brushes.
I like the idea of them. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to do my own sash windows. Those days are gone. But I'm quite interested in the idea of special brushes. Ooh. I like the angle of a brush, yes. So are you saying, Sophie, that you can make a cheap paint look better if it's applied with a good brush? Or you wouldn't go quite that far?
I'd say, so good brushes, thumbs up. Now, the quality paint question. We did sort of slightly cover this in our first series. Is expensive paint worth it? And I would say that most popular paint brands are a good enough quality, in my view, for most of the jobs that you want them to do. What we start questioning is the quality of the pigment and the quality of the colour starts coming into play. And a lot of the designer paint brands have more subtlety of colour. I mean, I'm going to flag up Farrah & Ball for a start. I mean, one of the reasons why they are such a huge success is because they get their colours absolutely perfect. And going back to talking about colour palettes and creating colour harmony and a group of colours that work together, their paint chart does all the work for you. You can use their colours throughout their home and you know they'll harmonise. So paint quality, I think, you know, in this day and age, technology is good enough. Most paint brands do the job. But it's when it comes to choosing the hue or colour, I think you've got some more to say on that as well, haven't you, Kate?
What I would say is that if you're someone who redecorates all the time, then I am not sure I would go to the expense of those very expensive paints, because you're going to spend a lot of money. You know, it's very expensive, that good paint, and you need to be pretty sure that that is the right colour. So you need to have done your colour psychology. You need to have read the books on creating the right home for you. At that point, you can maybe invest in expensive paint. But if you're just playing around with it or you're not sure, then I think you can get a very good finish with the more affordable paints. And the one other thing I would say in relation to this time we're in at the moment, I think what you're going to be craving in terms of decoration now is perhaps quite different to how you might feel when we come out of this. You might find now that you're drawn to kind of calm, pale colours, which are quite soothing for you. And when this is all over, you might suddenly want to coat everything in an explosion of joyous, energising, bright shades. So,
I can't wait to see the madhouse completely transformed into a rainbow of bright colours. I'll be tuning in for that.
Maybe not. In brief, I would say if you're absolutely certain of the colours and you know they're the ones for you, then yes, do invest. The paints are almost sort of like velvet and they change during the day as the different light falls on them. And it is a kind of magical thing, which you won't get from a flatter, cheaper paint. But you need to be really sure you're not redoing it. Yeah, absolutely.
And on the note of chalkier finishes, actually, my other thing that I was going to say, apart from quality, is getting the right paint for the right surface. And a lot of the very chalky designer paint brands are a nightmare if you're putting them into hallways or busy kitchen spaces, for example, because they don't wash down very well. And actually something like a Dulux diamond, they do a diamond finish, matte finish, and it's brilliant for high traffic areas.
It's tough.
It's really tough. Yeah. Or I have been known as well to even put an acrylic eggshell, which is really designed for woodwork, onto walls in small hallways because it's just so much more hard wearing than a flat matte emulsion. So you've got to really think about, again, the traffic in the area. I mean, going for some of these paints, again, is more expensive, the diamond emulsions or the acrylic eggshells, but you're not going to have to repaint your hallway over and over and over again. They'll be a lot longer lasting.
So I hope that was helpful, Catherine. And thanks to everyone who got in touch to say nice things about our staying in special. We're sorry if we didn't get to your question, but as you've just heard, we are going to be making style surgery a regular thing. So do send us your query in a voice memo on your phone. And remember, the email address is thegreatindoorspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like a bit of help with the recording, there are some simple instructions on the Facebook group page, The Great Indoors Podcast. And while you're there, there's loads of really other useful chat to distract you as well.
And of course, as always, we'll be sharing more tips, tricks and pictures relevant to this episode over on our blogs, madaboutthehouse.com and sophierobinson.co.uk. And do not forget to give us a raving review, a rate, and make sure you're subscribed. Or even better still, tell a friend that at this time, The Great Indoors Podcast is the show they want to listen to.
And thanks so much to our new sponsors, Geberit, and to our very long-suffering producer, Kate Taylor. And as ever, to you for listening.
And we'll see you in The Great Indoors.
Bada boom, right. Tish.
You can get out from underneath your... Oh, my hips. My hips. Sitting cross-legged on a child's bed.